strong values and strong opinions. The Mike Broomhead Show, KTAR News, 92.3 FM, and the KTAR News app.
All right, I'm Barry Markson in for Broomhead. Thanks for being here. And, oh, my goodness, Dave Burns is with us from 98.7 Arizona Sports. And, Burnsy, that has to be one of the most depressing sporting events I've ever experienced in my life.
Well, I mean, you start thinking about, right, the Super Bowl in San Antonio Holmes.
Yeah.
And you start thinking about, like, the Rose Bowl and Joe Germain and David Boston beating ASU in the last minute. I mean,
yeah, that's true.
But this one was next level, Barry. This one was next level. It was humiliating. It was embarrassing. To lose by that much, to be that disinterested, to have that kind of lack of effort or energy or want to or care, it was just a horrible way for a season to come to an end, and it's gonna leave a mark that is gonna be very, very difficult to remove for a lot of these guys.
Yeah, I agree with you, Burnsy. And it was, you know, we were watching this game, and you just kept thinking, well, they're gonna turn it on. Here it comes. You know, it's they're missing some shots, but they're gonna get there, and it just never came. The entire game, they just never got it together.
The second quarter, they quit. I mean, they just quit. It's like the worst thing you could ever say about a team or a player, but it's got to be said that they were down 10 at the end of the first quarter. Booker didn't have a point. Paul didn't have a point. Ayton didn't have a point. And you thought, at least I did, I thought, okay, all things being equal, to only be down 10 points in that situation, they'll be fine. It's the worst quarter of basketball they've played in forever and a day. They'll be fine.
Right.
And in the second quarter, Dinwiddie hit a couple of shots, and they quit. And that was the part that is going to stick with us now, not just until the next season starts, but honestly until next year's playoffs start, right? Where you're just never going to not be able to think about how badly they played and how so obviously they just gave up on that game last night. And it's so we're talking very literally months, I mean almost a year, until you're going to have an opportunity to kind of get that taste out of your mouth, and that's just going to make for a very long, insufferable wait for a lot of Suns fans.
Dave Burns is with us from 98.7 Arizona Sports, talking about the Suns' loss yesterday. And, you know, you're right. I think the Suns had 17 in the first quarter, if I'm remembering, and then only 10 in the second quarter, 27 points in the half. And I'm glad you said that they just quit, because it did seem like that. And I just heard something. I don't know if you've heard this, that because Ayton was basically benched, I think, early in the third quarter. And I heard Monty Williams asked him, do you even want to play? And that seems to be the attitude with some of these players. It was startling, to be honest with you.
Yeah, there was a longtime Suns fan, the guy who paints himself in orange. He calls himself Mr. Orange. He tweeted out last night during the game, after the game, that words were exchanged between the two of them, talking about Monty and DA now, and that there was, and I didn't see it, but going by his account here. But then after the game, Monty's very ominous. You know, it's internal when asked why DeAndre Ayton only played 17 minutes. And I mean, look, they've got a big decision about him this offseason, a lot of money. And to sit here and say that I think they're going to give it to him now, or that it's a no-brainer they give it to him now, I'd be lying to you if I said that. I have no idea what's going to happen with DeAndre Ayton, or what should even happen with DeAndre Ayton at this point, because it wasn't just him. It was Book. It was Paul, God bless him. Apparently he's got some sort of an injury, but it just kind of gets the feeling now where it feels like you're always going to have an injury that you're dealing with Chris Paul in this time of year. So it's a whole bunch of things last night.
Yeah. And I heard that too, that Paul was limping off the court afterwards. And I'm hoping we hear about some of this. I know they don't like to talk about injuries while things are going on. You don't want the other team to know anything, but I think it'd be helpful for the Suns fans to understand what happened to Chris Paul. I mean, the guy went from being the MVP of the playoffs to just dropping off the face of the earth altogether. And I hope it was an injury.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, but I was thinking exactly the same thing. At some point watching that game last night, I think I said to myself, God, I hope he's hurt.
Right.
hope he's hurt.
Yeah.
You know, because the alternative is that he's old. And the alternative is that he's just ran out of gas. But at the same time, wanting him to be hurt as an explanation for what happened last night doesn't do anybody any good either, because it just leads to the question of, well, how healthy is he going to be this time of year from now when he's 38 years old? What injuries will he be dealing with then? And so it's one of those be careful what you wish for things. And I feel like him being hurt provides an explanation for how poorly he's played in these last five games, but it does not set us up for a very bright future with Paul as kind of one of the centerpieces to this team moving forward. I think it's fair and it's legitimate to ask how much of a centerpiece he can be moving forward.
And Dave Burns joining us from Arizona Sports. But here's the question. I mean, Paul was out for part of the season, and the Suns did fine. Booker was out for part of it. They were able to replace those pieces, and the bench stood up and got things done. What happened? I mean, how did the Suns go from being the best team in the league by far, it wasn't even close, to a team that in the playoffs never looked good, and these last couple games against the Mavericks, I'm kidding about this, but it almost looks like they put some money on, hey, if we lose by over 30, we get 3-1. I mean, I don't know how you can get that bad after being that good so quickly.
It's the question that we're going to be asking as a fan base and as the media that covers this team for a calendar year. And I'd love to sit here and say I had an answer for you. In my mind, hearing you talk, the first kind of thing that pops into my mind is Devin Booker. It is that, you know, he's at some point in time in the next week or two, he is going to be named to an all-NBA first team or an all-NBA second team. He got more MVP votes than Luka Doncic, and in that moment, he did not rise up. And in those moments that you're referring to when Chris Paul was hurt, Devin Booker did. He played like a guy who was like, okay, I got this. I'm the man. I'll play like the man. Didn't play like the man yesterday. And the bench, I mean, maybe the most important thing this organization needs to do this offseason, other than make a decision about Ayton, is going to be find a veteran, capable, trustworthy backup point guard.
Yeah.
So in those moments when Chris Paul is showing his age or when he's hurt or when he can't contribute, they've got a more reliable option to turn to, because right now Campaign, Landry Shamet, not getting the job done, not even close to getting the job done when you need rotational depth at the guard position. And that's, you know, if I'm James Jones, you know, DA's top of my list. Figuring out a better backup guard, that's number two on my list right now, especially after the way they were exposed.
Campaign was another one that just kind of disappeared in the playoffs. I know he didn't play well in that first series. Did Monty just lose confidence in him and take him out of the rotation?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, he had to just, I mean, by the end of the series, we were seeing Landry Shamet get most of those minutes as the first guard off the bench. And, you know, he's very limited defensively. He played well earlier in the season. He's limited defensively. He doesn't have a ton of size. I think Monty lost faith in Cameron Payne, and there was such an erraticness to his game. He couldn't be trusted in those big moments. He just couldn't be.
Dave Burns with us. All right, Burns, last question. Is it, I mean, I think Monty's a great coach. He just won Coach of the Year, so it's odd for me to even ask this question, but did he get out-coached by Jason Kidd as far as making adjustments? Or, and this is what I tend to think it was, Dallas just seemed to want it more. They were hustling, they were moving, they played good defense. I mean, it just looked like that to a fan.
You can't lose four out of five games. You can't blow. I know it was just a 2-0 lead, but when you get outscored by, I haven't even done the math, but the Game 6 final and the Game 7 final into win and you advance moments, you absolutely have to look at Monty Williams. Now look, he's been one of the best things to happen in the Phoenix Suns organization. I hope he's the coach for years and years and years to come. But you better believe he's got to take a look at the mirror and figure out what he should have done sooner, what options he should have explored earlier in this series. I saw Pat Bev this morning on ESPN suggesting they should have benched Chris Paul. Was his loyalty to Chris Paul in the moment, you know, was that kind of a soft spot for him, or was it just simply a lack of options? I don't know. But you can't lose Game 6 and Game 7 by the number of points the Suns did without asking yourself, is this a coaching issue? And did he get out-coached? Yeah, Jason Kidd out-coached Monty Williams in those last two games. And four out of the last five games, Jason Kidd absolutely out-coached him, coming up with adjustments that Monty just could not answer in any way, shape, or form.
That's what it looked like to me as well. All right, Dave Burns, thanks for being here. You can listen to Burnsy on Arizona Sports 98.7, and thanks for the insight.
Thanks, Barry.
All right, coming up, Boy, that Suns game left a mark. There's no question about it. It's going to take a little while to get over that. But coming up, we're going to talk about the Buffalo shooting, but take a little bit of a different tack on it. We're going to talk about the rhetoric. I mean, this guy, the shooter, he had a manifesto, 180 pages. He laid out why he did this. And we've got some politicians and leaders, even in our own state, who kind of espouse the same stuff. We're going to talk about whether that's okay and why others don't call them out. We're going to call them out. I'm Barry Markson, in for Broomhead. It's KTAR.
Strong values and strong opinions. The Mike Broomhead Show. KTAR News, 92.3 FM and the KTAR News app.
All right, welcome back, everybody. It's the Mike Broomhead Show. I'm Barry Markson filling in. Mike's back on Tuesday. That's tomorrow. And boy, oh boy, we had that shooting in Buffalo. Just an unbelievably sad thing. And what makes it, I don't know if it's worse. I mean, people are dead, they're dead. But what makes it worse is the guy who did it was just he was a white nationalist. He's a racist. He's an anti-Semite by his own admission. And he is a big follower of this white replacement theory that Tucker Carlson and a whole lot of other people have been putting out there. And it's just disgusting. What's bothering me more than anything, more than the 10 people that are dead, and more than the fact that an 18-year-old can walk in New York with the gun laws that they have there, can walk into a store and buy a semi-automatic rifle and armored clothing and go around like a military guy and shoot up a grocery store to the point where he was even. I mean, this is the saddest part of this: is the security guard there at the store. Was a retired police officer.
Buffalo's police commissioner says 10 people died at the scene, including a security guard who was a retired Buffalo police officer being hailed a hero for his actions.
Engaged a suspect, fired multiple shots, struck the suspect, but because he had heavily armed armored plating on, that bullet had no round. The suspect engaged our retired officer and he was ultimately shot and deceased at the scene.
I mean, that's just the definition of a hero. But what bothers me, and I think should bother all of us, is that we have leaders here in Arizona, even, but we have leaders nationally and locally that are at least cavorting with white nationalists, that are talking about this white replacement theory like it's a real thing as opposed to a wacky fringe conspiracy thing. And it's causing issues. This guy flat out said, the murderer flat out said he saw this on the internet, was looking at it since he was 16. He's only 18 now. He got, it was just from extreme boredom because of the pandemic. And that's what got him all activated. That's what got him to where we are today. And it's not just, I mean, look, you can find stuff on the internet, but it's not just there. This stuff is being mainstreamed, and it's being mainstreamed by Tucker Carlson and Paul Gosar and Wendy Rogers, and to some extent to Carrie Lake and others, who act as if this is simply a new wing of the Republican Party. When you have Paul Gosar attending and speaking at white nationalist conferences and talking about this sort of thing, that's unbelievable to me. When you have Wendy Rogers doing that, Wendy Rogers put out a tweet right after this occurred in Buffalo and said this was a federal false flag operation, that this was a whole fake thing and the government put it on. What is going on right now? How is that okay? And here's what's going on. We look at Paul Gosar and Wendy Rogers like the crazy racist aunt and uncle that come to Thanksgiving that we see once a year, and we all kind of know what's going on, and we try to look away, and we just kind of put up with it and try to get through the few hours of dinner and move on with our lives. Well, this is ridiculous. These are our elected leaders. They have been voted on by us. And I'm not racist. I don't think you're racist. But why are we putting up with these people? Why? And where are the leaders in our state? Where are the Republican leaders in Arizona to say, I mean, when Doug Ducey asked about Wendy Rogers the last time she did and said something ridiculous that was racist, he said the option of having her, because he helped get her elected, gave her a whole bunch of campaign money. He said she was having her elected was better. There's a better option than the Democrat. Well, I'm going to tell you something. It's not. It's not. Electing a racist because we're on these teams now is just wrong. And there are options. Wendy Rogers and Paul Gosar can win election and re-election without saying this crazy white nationalist racist stuff. They're in easy districts. any Republican is going to win there. So the question is, why are they doing it if they're not white nationalists and racist? Why are they appealing to this fringe area, what used to be a fringe extreme of the party? And more importantly, why are leaders in the Republican Party allowing it? Where is Kelly Ward, who's supposed to be the chair of the Republican Party, to say, we are not racist, we are not white nationalists, we don't believe in the replacement theory, and anybody who's saying that is not showing Republican values? Where is Doug Ducey doing that? Where are the people running for governor? I mean, I'm going to call everybody out. Where's Carrie Lake? Carrie Lake has an endorsement from Paul Gosar. How is that okay? Let's renounce Paul Gosar. Where's Karen Taylor and Matt Salmon? Let's have people stand up, the leaders in Arizona and our Republican Party, and say, we have some extreme, crazy people in our party that are, I don't agree with them. I'm renouncing what they stand for, and I don't believe that they have Republican values. Why is that hard? All of us would hear that and say, yeah, I don't agree with that either. I'm not a racist, and I don't support racists. Why can't leaders in the Republican Party here in Arizona stand up and do that? It shouldn't be that hard. All right, coming up, we're going to talk about student loan. The student loan forgiveness thing, it's not going away. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about why the forgiveness is not a good idea, wouldn't be a good idea long term, and we'll talk about it next. It's KTAR.
Strong values and strong opinions. The Mike Broomhead Show. KTAR News, 92.3 FM and the KTAR News app.
All right, here we go, everybody. I'm Barry Marks and in for Broomhead, and thanks for joining us here on KTAR. The student debt thing is just fascinating to me. We have, as a country, we have over $1.7 trillion in student loans outstanding right now. Think about that for a minute. $1.7 trillion. Those are loans that have gone to you and me and our friends, our kids, our neighbors. It's all sorts of people. And it's become a huge thing. The amount of money it takes to go to college these days can be tremendous. And it what happens when all these people have debt is it slows down the normal evolution of a normal adult life, right? I mean, for most folks, you go to college. If you graduate from college, you get a job, you get married, you have children, you buy a house, right? All those things happen. And what we're finding, without question, is that all of this student debt is slowing that process. People are getting married later. They're buying homes later. They're putting off other expenses. You know, there are a lot of folks who have debt, maybe not the debt that looks like the size of a house. It's like you have a mortgage without the house. It's a huge amount of debt. And for many people, they look at it and realistically say, I will never pay this off in my lifetime. I'm making payments every month, but I will never get there. I make payments every month, but the interest is larger. And even though I'm making payments, it's either not going down or even going up. So you heard about this before the last election. A lot of progressives, starting with Elizabeth Warren and others, Bernie Sanders, they think that the government should forgive student debt, all of it. And Biden had said, no, I'm not going to do that. He's supposedly now entertaining some student debt forgiveness. But if you look at the statistics behind a lot of this, it makes doing anything substantial unlikely to have any real effect. And let me give you an example of that. First of all, if you do a forgiveness now, let's say we do what the Elizabeth Warrens of the world want, and Biden says by executive order, I'm going to forgive everybody, each and individual, I'm going to forgive up to $50,000 in debt. So if you have $50,000 or less in student loan debt, it's gone. You now are no longer in debt. If you have $100,000 or more, whatever it is, you still have that minus $50,000. Okay. I'm sure the people who have their debt forgiven will be thrilled. But how does that change anything for us in the long term? Because how expensive it is to go to college this year and next hasn't changed. The amount of student loans that are going to be rung up by the next generation are still going to be the same, if not more. It doesn't encourage universities and colleges to reduce the cost of going to school. It doesn't encourage kids who are going to college. It doesn't encourage them to find less expensive options. Go to a state school, go to community college first. It doesn't encourage any of that. It simply sets people up to think, well, I'm going to take on that debt because at some point they're going to forgive it again. Right? I mean, that's the thinking behind it. And the other part that we don't really hear a lot about here is that a lot of this debt is taken on by people who never graduate. 40% of people who have student debt didn't graduate from college. That's substantial. And those folks, it's not to say that those folks will never have the money to pay off the debt or pay it down. But if we go just by the statistics, if you have a college degree, you're likely to make more money over the course of your life. You may be less likely to be able to pay that off. But here's the thing. The folks with the most debt, the people you hear about who have $100,000, $200,000 in debt, those folks got advanced degrees. Those are people who went to medical school or law school or some sort of postgraduate degree. And the folks who do that are more likely to make more and more likely to be able to at least pay off or pay down that debt over time. Not everybody. I mean, I'll tell you, there's a whole bunch of articles about law school. And people go to law school and take on hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt thinking they're going to come out and make a bunch of money. And there's a whole lot of lawyers who don't make a lot of money. I mean, they may make more than average, but they're not making enough to pay off hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt and buy a house and a car and the other things that people do. So it is an issue for those people. But do you cut down if someone went to medical school and is going to be making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year? Do you say it's OK, we're going to forgive a major chunk of your debt? Do you do that or not? And of course, the other argument is, what about the people who didn't go to college at all? Why are we only giving money to people who went to college? What about the big part of our population that doesn't go to college? Should they get something? Should they have their new business loans or small business loans forgiven? Should they have their mortgage forgiven? Should we just give everybody and any loan, anybody's got a loan in the whole country, we're going to give you $50,000 off of it? I mean, there's a lot of things to do here. Now, I will say there are other options, and I'm always surprised that nobody talks about this. Almost all of the $1.7 trillion in student debt is owned by the federal government. People are making these payments to the government now. Why? And they have higher than normal interest rates. Why can't we start by saying we're going to make these loans interest-free or very low interest? Why can't we do that? Why can't we say instead of paying whatever they're paying now, 5%, 7%, 4%, why can't we say it's a 1% loan? Now, the interest on your loan is 1%. Why can't we say if you pay it off in a certain number of years, we'll match payments? Right? Like if you pay at least the double the minimum that's required, the government will put something in and help you get it down. You know what I'm saying? So in other words, instead of forgiving loans for people who aren't doing anything to pay them off, how about incentivizing payments? How about doing something to, hey, we're going to be in this with you and figure that part of it out. And more importantly, where's the program to say we're going to go talk to high school kids and their families and talk to them not just about go to the best school you can get into, but let's consider the expense of this, because there's an awful lot of kids who go to really expensive, you know, $50,000, $60,000 a year colleges and are getting degrees in areas that are never going to pay large salaries. And that's okay. There's a need for people who do social work. There's a need for social scientists. There's a need for sociologists and psychologists and all sorts of folks. Those are good things. I'm glad that people can go and get degrees in the liberal arts, what we used to call the liberal arts, and just have the arts themselves. Those are good degrees for our society. But I think there should be some thought behind that. I mean, should you be spending $250,000 for a 4-year degree in something that it is incredibly unlikely you will ever earn enough to pay down that debt? And if you do, should there be some sort of a discussion and a sign-off by you and your parents to say, hey, yeah, I know I'm taking on all this debt and I'm basically never going to pay it off? Because that's the part that gets me, and I think for a lot of people, and it was the same thing after the recession back in 2008, 2009. It was all those folks who were trying to get loan forgiveness for their homes. And I remember at the time thinking, I didn't go out and buy a bigger house. I didn't go out and borrow more money and get a bigger house because I could at the time. I said, I want to live within my means and do this. And then these people did that. They went out and spent all their money. They leveraged themselves to the hilt. And then when things went bad, they said, I want loan forgiveness. I want my loan to be rewritten at less money. And I'm looking at them going, why? I did the right thing. Why do you get the benefit? And at some level, isn't that what we're doing here with these college loans? Is there's people, I mean, my wife and I are fortunate enough that we could save for our kids to go to college, and our kids are going to go to college. Even with that, they're going to colleges that are less expensive and aren't going to cost that an arm and a leg. Why can't other people do that? Why do you have to go to the college, your dream college? You want to go to your dream college and you want to borrow the money to do it? Okay, but you owe the money. Don't go do that and then show up later and say, I don't want to pay this money anymore. This is killing me. I can't buy a car. It's like, what? This person went to a state school and now they can buy a car. They made a decision. They didn't go to their dream school. This person went to community college for 2 years because it costs almost nothing, and they still have a four-year degree that they went, they transferred, got a real degree, a four-year degree afterwards. They did it in a way that made sense. Why do you get the benefit of your actions and they don't? Those are the questions. It's difficult. And it's not going to go away anytime soon. And we'll see what the Biden administration does. It looks like they might do like a $10,000 forgiveness, something like that. But I think the real issues we need to figure out are, how do we make colleges more reasonably priced? How do we stop them from raising prices so much that it's well above inflation and it just keeps going up and up because they know that the government will just keep loaning more and more money? Those are the big issues that need to be resolved. All right, on the other side, we're going to give you an update. What's going on in Ukraine? Some good news from the Ukrainians. And also, we have some new countries that are joining NATO. We're going to give you Putin's reaction to that next. It's KTAR.
Strong values and strong opinions. The Mike Broomhead Show. KTAR News, 92.3 FM and the KTAR News app.
All right, here we go. I'm Barry Marks, and in for Broomhead. Thanks for joining us. Man, oh man. Still coming off that loss yesterday. I just can't get over it. I was just reading more about it now. Oh, my goodness. All right. I want to give you an update on what's going on in the Ukraine. I mean, some good news, and what's happening there. Ukraine just pushed Russia back out of Kyiv, which is the second largest city in Ukraine, kind of what they did out of Kyiv the first time. This is another city. And then on top of that, Russia retreating back into Russia, and they're blowing up bridges and things in Ukraine as they retreat to try to slow the Ukrainian forces' forward momentum, which is pretty amazing. So some good things there. Anthony Blinken, the Secretary of State, talking now about NATO and others in the area wanting to join NATO. This is amazing. It's the exact opposite of what Putin wanted. The exact opposite.
Every member of the alliance wants to bring this war to an end as soon as possible. But we're equally determined to maintain our security assistance to Ukraine, to continue our sanctions, export controls, and diplomatic pressure on Russia for as long as it's necessary. The United States and our allies and partners are focused on giving Ukraine as strong a hand as possible on the battlefield and at any negotiating table so that it can repel Russian aggression and fully defend its independence and sovereignty.
All right, it's Anthony Blinken talking about the Secretary of State, talking about NATO and what's going on there. It's interesting now, Finland and Sweden are really lining up to join NATO. This is something you have to remember. These countries are on Russia's border. I mean, that they've been kind of the neutral buffer zone between Russia and NATO countries. And now they're saying, yeah, we want to join NATO. We need this protection because they're watching what Putin did with Ukraine and saying, what keeps him from doing that to us? What keeps Putin from having Russia invade Finland or Sweden? And they've never done that. Sweden's been neutral and independent forever. So it's really pretty amazing. The president of Finland, has been speaking out now. They're ready to go. And he spoke with Vladimir Putin. Putin didn't have nice things to say.
Actually, why I called him, I wanted just to confirm that now the situation is changed. We are going to apply membership. And in the same way, he confirmed that he thinks it's a mistake. We are not threatening you. Altogether, the discussion was very, would I say, calm and cool. And he didn't repeat those threats he had earlier and his people had been telling. That is that if Finland joins, that means some kind of contra steps, military contra steps, whatever that meant. But he didn't repeat it now, so I was not necessarily surprised, but it was, like I said, quite calm and cool.
Yeah, he had spoken with him before, and Putin got upset and said, if you're going to join NATO, we're going to put more troops on our border there. We're going to heighten the relationship in a bad way between Russia and Finland. And Finland, I think they're doing the right thing. I think Finland has sat there for a long time and said, Russia hasn't bothered us. We don't want to get involved. And they look now and say, look what you're doing to Ukraine. You are destroying this country and just just wiping cities off the map. And Finland's, you know, they have a very nice little life there. They have kind of a socialist world that they live in there, and everybody's very happy, and it's, they don't want that to go away. So I welcome them into NATO. You know, some people are concerned about adding more countries in, but I welcome them. The Turkish president, Erdogan, he's the only one who came out with any reservations on this last week, but even he has come out now and said, I will not stand in the way of Finland and Sweden joining NATO. And that's important, because all of the current NATO countries have to approve any new addition. So it's a big step. And the Finland, the president of Finland, he went on to give a little bit more. And this was, I thought this was fascinating, his discussion with Vladimir Putin.
They are ready to attack a neighboring country. If that would be the case that we join, well, my response would be that you caused this. Look at the mirror.
He told Vladimir Putin, he told him, you caused this. Look in the mirror. You want to know why this is happening? It's because of you. It's because of your actions. I mean, if Russia was a real democracy, I have to think the people there would be saying, we got to get this guy out of office. We just got to go. But he's an authoritarian leader. He has pretty strong control there. It's going to take a military turnaround. It's going to take the people protesting in the streets. I don't know what it takes to get rid of him. But it's going to take a lot of those oligarchs, the rich people who've been making a ton of money off of Vladimir Putin, losing money. It's going to take some combination of that to make this change. But anybody, any Russian looking at this has to say, what are you doing? You're attacking our cousins. That's Ukraine. Ukraine was part of Russia. These are our friends and relatives. Why are we doing this? There was really no risk. Ukraine wasn't going to attack Russia. Don't be ridiculous. And now, because of what you've done, you've heightened all of the enemies around us who aren't even enemies, our friends and neutral people around us. They're doing it now. It's bad. All right, coming up, we got a news update. Jeff Mund in the KTR News Center. And then we're going to talk about the cyber ninjas. Today's the big day. They're supposed to give us 60,000 pages. We'll give you an update next. It's KTAR.